We welcome back to the show and back here in the studio with us, author, a University of Maine professor in communication and journalism, the author of 6 Minutes in Berlin, Michael Sokolow joining us. Mike, welcome back.
Good afternoon, Rich.
Great to have you here with us. The last time you were on, it was by phone from Australia.
That's right. It was Canberra, Australia, and I called you from the day ahead.
That's right. Yeah, you were there for the semester and sounded like you had a wonderful experience there. And you can obviously, as a result of that, really identify with the devastation that they're going through now.
Yeah, I'm following all the news that I followed down there, and it's just incredible. I mean, I don't think we're getting any sense of the scale here or the size. I mean, we're hearing numbers like a billion animals but if you actually knew the geographic locations, it would be mind-boggling. I mean, to give you one sense, we used to go to this beach from Canberra about 2 hours away, and everything, I mean, just the devastation between the city. It would be like Bangor to Seals Harbor or Bar Harbor. Imagine if all the highways were closed, thousands of homes were just gone, and you couldn't, there was no way in or out for anybody.
Well, and someone did an overlay on social media, placing Australia over the United States and then showing all of the fires just to really illustrate the enormity of this. And it's just hard to grasp.
It's hard to grasp for a bunch of different reasons, like not just the geographic scale, but also the air is so bad. It's so bad that you can go on YouTube, for instance, and see people driving around with their respirators on. And so we'll never really know the full cost of this in terms of the health of the people who are breathing this stuff. I mean, everything's closed in Canberra.
Right.
I mean, like Canberra, where I lived, Australia National University, University of Canberra, all the schools are shut down. And you see the restaurants, nobody's going out to eat. The whole economic situation has come to a standstill.
And you would hope, but I don't think it's going to happen, you would hope that people would see this as yet another wake-up call that if climate change is real. This is, the science is real. It's not a fantasy.
Yeah, Australia was already far ahead of us in understanding climate change.
Well, except their prime minister, right?
Well, no, even the right wing, he supports coal so much, Scott Morrison, ScoMo, but even they only want to talk about the cost of mediation. They admit it's happening because in Australia you cannot ignore it. But one of the things about their prime minister that's fascinating to me is he comes from public relations. We've never had a president who actually comes from public relations, not from broadcasting. I mean, he was on The Apprentice or anything, but public relations. He is so good, their prime minister, that I don't know if you saw this. Everything he's saying now is so market tested. So he's saying, now is not the time to talk about blame and responsibility. But at the same time, he's saying, this is really an arson question. Why are we lighting these fires? He's misdirecting attention perfectly. I mean, as a scholar of propaganda, I study this and I write about it. He is so talented.
Wow. What's the global cost, not financial cost, but what's the impact of this going to be?
It's fascinating. I'm not sure if you consider the scale and size of it, I'm not sure we'll ever figure it out for a whole bunch of different reasons. I mean, one very simple reason is there aren't very many people in Australia. It's a massive continent. You have basically the New York City metropolitan area of population over a continent the size of the United States. So there's tens of thousands of acres that are just disappearing, and nobody knows the long range, cost that it'll be.
And spinoffs that we don't even think about. Originally, Eric Meehan, Bangor Wine and Cheese, was in the other day talking about the fact that Australia has been such a huge wine producer over the years, and a devastating blow to that.
Absolutely. And, you can't believe the statistics you're getting because the government is self-interested. So, for instance, they say only 25 people have died so far. It's many more than that. If you go to, for instance, Reddit Canberra or Reddit Australia or places like this, they have cases of people on respirators who the particulate of the air is so bad that people are dying from that, and they don't, that doesn't count because they're not burned up. They didn't lose their house in a fire. It's just bad air they're breathing. And so that's the kind of costs that we don't see that are just horrific.
And why, and this is not unique, but why is it that Americans just don't seem to be very concerned about this? Is it as simple as, well, it's all the way on the other side of the world?
Well, that's what drives me crazy. I kept on Twitter, I kept saying, hey, why is American media not paying attention, not understanding it? I think that's the first thing. A professor at Harvard, that was his reply to me, was, hey, this is happening 10,000 miles from America. But the other thing, I think, and it would be fascinating to see if this ever happened somewhere in Europe or the United States, I don't think the scale of what's happening is I don't think we can imagine it as a narrative. So, for instance, you might have heard of they're going to cull in 5 days 10,000 feral camels in South Australia. I don't know if you saw this. It's going to start this Saturday. And it's because the feral camels are drinking the humans' water supply. They've had a drought for several years. They need as much water as they can get to fight these fires and everything. And so between this Saturday and next Tuesday, 10,000 feral camels in South Australia are going to be shot from helicopters because there's no way to get to them otherwise.
Right.
I mean, how do you imagine that?
You can't.
You can't go in the Everglades. We're not going to have a situation where you go in the Everglades or go into, northern Maine and need to cull animals like that. So that's what I mean when I say I don't think the scale is understandable to American journalists. The other thing that isn't understandable is how hot it is there. I don't know if you've heard, but, Penrith, which is a suburb of Sydney, hit 120 degrees. Oh. This is separate from the fire.
Wow.
The smoke is coming in. You can't breathe. You're running electricity. They're not even running the brows. This is mind-boggling. I mean, Americans can't imagine 120 degrees for 4 or 5 days straight.
No, not at all. We're talking with Michael Sokolow here on Downtown. Let's shift into the world of politics. And you were telling us before we came on, you've got an exciting assignment coming up. You're going to the Iowa caucuses.
That's right. A nonprofit out of Los Angeles that does educational and civic education called Kid Unity has invited me to be part of the program. And so I'll be in Des Moines on Monday, February 3rd for the caucus.
Wow. All right. So let me ask you this then. Is the caucus still the best way to go when it comes to choosing candidates? Because it tends to be primarily activists, and they're often at the extremes in each political party.
Well, I've only physically been to one caucus before here in Maine in 2012, just to look. It was Republican, and I wasn't a Republican participant. And it's exactly as you say, right? Because you have the multiple votes, you have the call to order, you have this and that. And I found it fascinating. I talked to my colleague, Professor Amy Freed at University of Maine. We ended up writing a piece on it because Ron Paul won. There was no question that Ron Paul won the most votes in the caucus in 2012. And the Republican Party literally took through superdelegates, through all this political maneuvering, and made the winner Mitt Romney. And to me, I'd never seen anything like that before. It's fascinating. So I wrote a piece for Reuters on it, co-authored with. Because also I didn't understand how it could happen. She had to explain it to me, so that's how we are.
Well, it is the ultimate in political deal-making at the grassroots level.
I mean, another example is the Republicans in Iowa in 2016 did it by voting, and the Democrats did it by caucusing. And when you look at the actual numbers of 2016, they're fascinating. Ted Cruz won Iowa by 6,000 votes over, and he won more delegates than Donald Trump. Yet on the Democratic side, it was this brutal fight having to do with proportionality in the caucus. And the final result, nobody remembers this, was Hillary Clinton 49.9 and Sanders 49.3. It was a 0.6% difference. And I'll tell you, journalists, I don't think, report it well because I don't remember Sanders coming that close that early on.
Now, we were also talking about this before we came on the 19th, 10 days away, the New York Times is going to announce who they're endorsing for the Democratic nomination, and it's going to be quite a production.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me. By the way, the author of the piece who announced it today is Kathleen Kingsbury. She's a Pulitzer Prize winner who used to be at the Boston Globe, and we had her up here at UMaine for Pulitzer Week a couple years
wonderful.
Ago. She's great. But in her rollout on Twitter, she said there's going to be a television show. There's going to be full video, full transcripts of every interview they do in the boardroom with each of the candidates. And there's going to be a podcast explaining how they made their decisions. There's going to be interviews with the board members as well as with the candidates. It's an absolutely massive. I've never seen anything like it. Multimedia extravaganza. I'm curious who they'll choose, but the rollout itself as a production is fascinating.
And why do you think they're going to this extent to explain their decision?
Well, there's a couple interesting thoughts jumping around at Twitter. One is that their podcast is doing very well, their daily podcast, but their TV and their video is not doing as well. And that they're going to try and leverage this, basically take that podcast audience and feed them to get more video and more stuff like that. But I also wonder if this is what happens when you move from advertising to a subscription base. In other words, they have to please their Democratic readership in new ways that they didn't have to previously.
Right.
I mean, the truth is, if they are as balanced as they say they are, or as they are open, independent, neutral, objective, you choose the words, they would endorse somebody in the Republican primary as
well. Exactly, yeah.
But there's no announcement of that yet. Perhaps that'll happen. But
And is it, because I can't even recall, is it common practice to endorse a candidate in the primaries?
It's actually not. And it's not for a bunch of really good reasons. I just finished Brian Rosenwald's book called Talk Radio America. And in it, he says that Rush Limbaugh does not endorse in the primary for a bunch of different reasons, even when he makes it very, very clear. Like, everybody forgets, Rush Limbaugh basically said, vote Ted Cruz in 2016.
Right.
But he doesn't do it because it doesn't work. And when Rush Limbaugh can't deliver, his irrelevance is made clear. And Limbaugh's smart enough to know this. And if you look at who the Republicans have nominated since Limbaugh became gigantic, like Bob Dole, George W. Bush, McCain, and then Mitt Romney, none of them were the Limbaugh alternative.
Well, and you've written about this in regards to Fox News and the perception that people have of their influence, and that maybe it's not as great, at least when it comes to choosing candidates or electing candidates, as we might think.
Rosenwald's book is really interesting on this, because you get to see Republican politicians really struggling with this, like Speaker John Boehner and Paul Ryan, and Republicans who are serious about governance, who are thinking about how to pass bills and how to make America better in certain ways, quote unquote, more effective governance, let's put it that way, are being misled by the perception that right-wing talk radio is stronger than it really is, because it doesn't show up in the voting booth, even in the primaries for Republicans.
And even Fox News, despite their numbers, and yes, they're in many ways the most watched news, but that's still not a lot of people.
Let's put it this way. Fox News on a very good night, it gets about 3.5 million viewers. On an average night, ABC World News Tonight gets 8.6 million. Okay, we're a country of 330 million. So 99.7% of the citizens of the United States are not watching Fox News on any given night. But it's this perception. That's the problem. People who work in the media constantly talk about Murdoch, constantly talk about Fox News. But if we didn't give it the oxygen that we do, I'm not even going to say it has the influence it does, because I don't think it has quite the influence it says it does.
So, Michael, what is the value of an endorsement, whether it's from a newspaper or whether this week with Julian Castro announcing his support for Elizabeth Warren, if not in bringing people to that side, surely there's some value.
Well, I might be giving away my column here, and I might, because I've been asked, just disclosure, I've been asked by an editor to write on it. And I was DMing with Jack Schaefer of Politico today about this kind of thing. And so I might be giving something away here, might ruin Jack's column.
It's just us, so no one's going to hear it anyway.
That's good. But here's the real deal. It's been studied, newspaper endorsements, and it's called the third person effect. And what it is the endorsement itself does not influence people. It influences very, very few people. But what it does is it creates the illusion that other people are now going to vote. And so people read the endorsement and they say, well, wait a minute, this candidate has more voters than I thought they did. Hmm. And that it's called the bandwagon effect, and it's been studied. And that is
speaking
the power
of propaganda. Right?
That is the power of an endorsement, is it convinces people that other people are going to vote. And it's the idea of I need to get with other people that's influential. It's not this newspaper has authority. And by the way, if you ever want to check the authority of newspapers to swing an election, look at 2016. Donald Trump, I believe, was endorsed by 3 or 4 newspapers, none bigger. I think the biggest was in San Mateo, California, or San Marco, California, something like that.
Wow.
And Hillary Clinton had over 200 endorsements.
Now, we still don't know the impact that Facebook and social media had on the last election, but I think it's very interesting, the news that they plan absolutely no change to their policy when it comes to politicians advertising and targeting people.
I'm a cynic when it comes to Facebook. Facebook is constantly apologizing, and which tells you all you really need to know about them. But also, something else that you need to know about them is that Peter Thiel is on their board of directors.
Right.
You know, and so this is the world that they consider. I mean, it even disturbs me when they say, oh, we're going to change the ad policies, we're going to be more careful about advertising, because everybody knows the trolls and the bots aren't buying ads.
Right, right.
Right? They're creating this. Twitter is also disturbing. I like Twitter a little better, but it's disturbing on one thing. You know that right now, it would be very easy for Twitter to identify and get rid of these trolls and these bots, but it would hurt their growth numbers. It would hurt their engagement numbers. They would get less advertising revenue. It would make them less influential. And so everything about the system is geared towards keeping the trolls and bots alive. You know, that's the real problem.
I was reading a while back, and you may recall her name, the woman who is essentially in charge of Facebook News and has talked about her efforts to keep everything on the straight and narrow, but then she's got this separate life and identity that's very biased in one direction.
Yes, Campbell Brown.
Yes,
Campbell Brown, a former mainstream news organization, news person. But right, you know, Facebook isn't, the thing that cracks me up is back in the middle of the 20th century, the people running CBS, NBC, and ABC would say, oh, we're right down the middle. You know, we're objective. We're in this kind of consensus thing. Facebook's not that smart yet. Like, if Facebook really put it together, that's what they would do. They would say, oh, we can't do this or that because we really need to show all of you. We need to blah, blah, blah. And this. No, they, exactly like this Campbell Brown, or, you know, they need to pretend they're more effective than they are. I know that sounds strange, but in the advertising world and the metrics they work in, they can't play the naive empiricist that the guys running CBS, NBC, and ABC did back in the 1970s.
Were the networks, and of course you have a family connection there, but were the networks down the middle, or was that some well-crafted PR?
I'm invested in this. So my father was the producer of the CBS Evening News. So I'll phrase it this way, with the caveat and disclaimer that I'm self-interested here. I think the level of professionalism involved was much, much higher. I think they were liberal. My father was a liberal. Walter Cronkite was a liberal. Everybody around him. I think they were liberal in certain ways. Let's be clear about that. But they were conservative in other ways. But I think the level of professionalism, the idea that we have to be accurate, was much higher back then.
Well, and my perception, of course, growing up in that time period, first of all, it was all we knew. And you didn't have 24-hour news channels, the sources for media information were much more limited, but I always viewed it as an early and young consumer of the news as the number one objective being speaking truth to power. And that wasn't based on political party. It was based on that old adage, afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted.
Yeah, yeah. And one thing we forget is the news shows. And even when CNN started, it was like this. You have such little time that they were basically wire services. Where could we get the pictures and video from, and how could we do this? But the problem was they were making a lot of money and they were investing it in bureaus around the world. Today, all these corporations, they'll just take any video. I mean, you watch your local news now and it's something you saw on Twitter or Reddit. It's, you know, a squirrel water skiing or some kind of viral video that they got for cheap. It costs money to produce really good news, and I don't think the will is there anymore.
But you've written, too, and I found this very interesting. Sometimes there's a perception with the networks, the major networks, that news is a loss leader, and you've said nothing could be further from the truth.
No, that's my theory. I mean, my theory is they're not making enough money, because back in the days when the CBS Evening News, here's a little fact. The single highest advertising vehicle in the United States in 1966 was the Huntley-Brinkley Report. It made $27 million. The CBS Evening News was second. It made $25 million. And when you have that much money, you can go after the president. You can tell the American people that, you know, Vietnam isn't working out.
Right.
And your president is a crook, despite what he said. When you have that much money, your corporation is going to back you up. When you're in a perilous state and you're relying on a different kind of revenue basis and people can boycott you, and all kinds of things, it makes it much scarier, I think.
And even at the local level, and I don't think it's changed that much since I was working in local TV, that was always the top dollar for local advertising, was to be in those local newscasts.
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting. We were talking about WABI before and Hildreth Communications. You know, when they sold to Gray, this is Channel 5 in Bangor for people around here, I didn't realize this, but did you know that Hildreth was the last original television license owner in the entire United States?
I didn't know that.
To sell to a national chain.
Well, I remember working with Hottie Hildreth, who just passed away recently, and the Hildreth family, and that was a time we've gotten away from that, when you had family-owned broadcast companies. Now, we're one of the last here before the conglomerates came in, largely in radio, but now even more so in television. And that's a whole can of worms we could discuss another time, whether it's what the Cox companies do or what Sinclair Broadcasting is doing.
Sure. But, you know, a really conservative person up here in this market would say, wait a minute, there was a Governor Hildreth who leveraged that TV station. So, you know, LBJ, everybody forgets. How did LBJ get rich? And how did LBJ... Right. use his, spread his money around. He became the Senate Majority Leader in his second term in the Senate, which is unheard of. And it was because he was taking all this money out of his radio station in Austin, Texas.
I want to ask you about this. Portland Press Herald announced recently that starting in March, their Monday edition will be online only. No more print, no more delivery of Monday newspapers. Clearly a sign of things to come in the newspaper industry.
Yeah, I have to be careful about this because I was on the board of the Maine Press Association. And my student, Casey Kelly, who works at the University of Maine, wrote an excellent piece for Columbia Journalism Review on what's happening in Maine. You know, we're the state that has only two daily newspaper owners.
Right.
And the only state in America. And so it's absolutely fascinating. Everybody's looking at us as sort of the canary in the coal mine because every daily newspaper in the state, except for the Bangor Daily News, is owned by a single person, Reed Brower. And so, I don't know. I know that the printing company is subsidizing the actual newspaper. But without knowing the numbers, I can't say. I will say this. I have great confidence in the people who put together the Portland Press Herald. I mean, and Maine Today Media. It's not called Maine Today Media. Lisa DeSisto and all the editors and the columnists, the people like Bill Nemitzer. They're
absolutely
terrific. They're national level. And I did hear that they were not going to have layoffs as part of this cutback. And so that's good. If that's true, that's really good.
Did newspapers misjudge what would become the rapid growth of the internet and realize fully what was likely to happen in their industry? Are they playing catch up now?
There's a great podcast with John Skipper of ESPN talking about this with Bill Simmons. And they say, absolutely. They say, look, how did newspapers allow the Village Voice and the alternative papers to come in and eat their lunch on entertainment advertising? How did Craigslist come in? How did newspapers miss, X, Y, and Z as you go down the line? But I don't know. And the other idea is that, wait a minute, newspapers were a product that had a 300-year run of profitability, which no product ever has had. And so, it's whether they run their course. So I'm not sure yet. I'm hoping for the best because I'm an old newspaper fan.
Me too. And I still get a couple of Sunday papers delivered to my house because I still love that feel of opening up the paper and drinking my coffee and folding it the right way and going through all that. And I don't know. This is not the death of newspapers by any stretch. It's a different format, but it certainly changes things. And you talked about it earlier with the New York Times, because now you've got to offer something more for those subscribers, more original content that you can't find if you get that print edition.
Yeah, and I went to a fascinating talk once where they were saying you have to start gearing the news in the newspaper for people buying it as a special thing. So, for instance, one of the things they said is local high school sports have to start having more names and numbers. They have to have more data so that the family can buy three clippings, three copies and clippings and stuff. And, maybe that'll work. I don't know. But there are these theories. And some papers have solved it. Some papers are doing. The Ellsworth American did not put everything on the web and did better than most newspapers in America in that way. So I'm not sure.
Well, it's a fascinating time. Michael, always great to talk with you. Thanks so much for coming in today. Hopefully we can catch up with you when you're in Iowa.
Yeah, maybe I'll call in. I'll let you give you, maybe I'll break the embargo, give you an early return.
Excellent. We love it. Thanks so much, Michael.